Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. It's Here and Now. President Trump has landed in Hamburg, Germany for a summit of world leaders. Police there are bracing for protests. But earlier today in Warsaw, Poland, a friendly crowd showed up. Some of them bussed in so they could show their support for Trump as he spoke about security threats to the U.S. and to Europe.
But today we're in the West, and we have to say there are dire threats to our security and to our way of life. You see what's happening out there. They are threats. We will confront them. We will win. But they are threats.
Polish journalist Michał Szulczynski is in Warsaw, joining us by Skype. He's a columnist for the newspaper Rzeczpospolita, which means the Republic. Michał, the White House was hoping that this would be a warm and harmonious first leg of the trip for Donald Trump. Was it? And what's your headline?
Yeah, it was really, President Trump was really warm welcomed in Poland, especially because there was a lot of references to Polish history in his speech. He told about a Polish struggle with communism, with Nazis during the Second World War, and this idea of Polish fight for democracy, for freedom. So he knew how to get the hearts of Poles.
Donald Trump said that he supports NATO's shared defense. This is after he was criticized for not emphasizing that on his first trip to Europe. This has to do with Article 5. How did he frame that?
He said that Poland and America are standing arm in arm. We have now 5,000 American soldiers here, crucial for Polish and also Baltic states, because Russia is the biggest threat for safety in the region.
Did he miss anything that you think the Polish people wanted to hear?
I don't think so. Some critics of both Polish government and both of President Trump were afraid that President Trump will use Poland to split European Union or to split Europe. But he didn't do so. He said that Poland or strong Poland is important for Europe and strong Europe is important for the whole West. So nobody can say that Mr. Trump said anything to, let's say, divide Poland and Germany or Poland and European Union. So from that point of view, his speech was satisfying for everybody, not only for supporters of this government, but also for those who were afraid of some movements of the Polish government, which are criticized by Brussels and some Western Europe countries.
President Trump addressed head-on the issue of radical Islamic terrorism, and he put it under the rubric of immigration. Let's hear what he said.
While we will always welcome new citizens who share our values and love our people, our borders will always be closed to terrorism and extremism of any kind.
The people of Poland are dealing, of course, with a real onslaught of migration from Africa, from the Middle East, from Northern Africa. How do people there hear that kind of talk from the president?
And once more, this was strong support for Polish government. Polish government is quarreling with European Union, with European Commission, which wants every member state to take quotas of migrants and asylum seekers who are in refugee camps in Greece and Italy. But Polish government says that it's impossible for security reasons, because you cannot check every person in these camps, because they have no documents with them, no IDs, and nobody knows who they are. So these words of President Trump that everybody has to have the sovereign migrant policy is a big help for Polish government.
There is yet another area of overlap between President Trump and President Duda of Poland, and that has to do with their dislike, shall we say, of the press, of the media. Mr. Duda, he has tried to restrict the media's access there, your access included. That apparently did not happen. President Trump had some words for CNN today, again, derisive words. And I understand that there were some shouts of fake news from the crowd. To what extent do the two see eye to eye on getting the media as far away as possible?
I think that in this aspect, President Duda and President Trump understand each other very well, because they think or they perceive that they do not deserve the criticism in media reports.
Thank you very much for speaking with us. Mikhail Szczelczynski of the newspaper in Poland, Rzeczpospolita. Thank you again.
Thank you very much.
And staying with President Trump's relationship with the media and CNN, the network is facing tough questions this week after its response to a video tweeted by the president on Sunday. The video was old footage of Trump body slamming a rival in a pro wrestling match. But in this version, Trump's opponent had the CNN logo superimposed on his head. CNN tracked down the Reddit user, who it says is behind the video, and found he had a history of racist and anti-Semitic posts. Those posts have been taken down, and the user has apologized, but the controversy is a result of the story that CNN published in response. The network said it was withholding the man's name to protect his privacy, but reserved the right to publish his identity if he were to, quote, repeat this ugly behavior on social media. And now some are accusing CNN of blackmail. NPR's media correspondent David Folkenflik has been following this story. Hi, David.
Hey, Peter.
So the line in question here says CNN reserves the right to publish his identity should any of that change, you know, referring to his online behavior. I have never read a line like that in my entire career. I wonder if you have and what your thoughts are.
You know, this seems to me to be clumsy. I understand why people take look askance at it. It looks like they're threatening to say, we're going to hold this over your head if you do this. And in the meantime, you know, we're going to be the arbiter of your behavior, we here at CNN. I actually think they were doing something quite different. Hmm. I think they were, as they later said, attempting to make clear that they hadn't struck any deal with the guy and that the power to publish or not publish, you know, was held by them. And I think what they were really trying to say in an exceptionally clumsy and poorly phrased way was that they reserved the right to reveal who he was if he became newsworthy once again. And remember, what he's, you know, what they're worried about is he ends up posting more racist, bigoted, anti-Semitic stuff. And then suddenly they're in the uncomfortable position of seemingly taking a stand publicly to say that they're not going to show who he is publicly. The key thing to remember is this was the source from which the White House derived that video. And we can return to that. But, you know, that's an important thing. He is an of interest to people. It's not they're not doing some sort of a vigilante quest here.
So you're making the point that it was, in fact, newsworthy. So in that case, should they have just named the guy?
I think there's a legitimate case for naming him. They said that they had real concerns about his safety, and we live in a funny time, as in to say not very funny at all, at which people get threatened, at least in the social digital realm, for things they do there. And there's concerns about that being transposed into real life. If you think about Pizzagate and what happened not so many months ago of a guy shooting up a pizza parlor based on foundless claims, you know, that somehow that was a place where Democrats were selling children into prostitution. You know, when you think of what happens there, there are real world consequences. They said they didn't want to do it. I think there was a case for them very much to do it, but they could have not named him with a lot less fanfare and just said, you know, at this time, we're not choosing to name him.
And meanwhile, this all just becomes fodder for the network's critics, including the president. Here's what he said today at a press conference while he was in Poland.
CNN has really taken it too seriously, and I think they've hurt themselves very badly, very, very badly. And what we want to see in the United States is honest, beautiful, free, but honest press. We want to see fair press. I think it's a very important thing. We don't want fake news. And by the way, not everybody is fake news, but we don't want fake news. Bad thing. Very bad for our country.
So here's the deal, David Folkenflik. CNN now finds itself at the center of a story that involves Donald Trump. The White House had been pouncing on the network because it had to retract a story about Russia last month that was related to the White House. What kind of damage is all of this doing to CNN?
I think the real harm occurred when Jeff Zucker, in attempting to identify the stakes for CNN in an era when the president and his administration is targeting CNN as one of its primary public enemies and desperate for its affirmation instead of its investigations, Jeff Zucker, the head of CNN, said, "We have to play error-free ball." And he's talking about that as an aspiration. But when you say it that clearly, suddenly the stakes are such that CNN basically forced out or fired three senior investigative journalists who had committed, in my view, at least from what we know publicly, not to have been a capital offense, a firing offense. And by saying we've got to commit error-free ball, it entitles media critics, but also particularly conservatives, Trump apologists, and people who don't really like Trump on the right but who nonetheless want to find something else to stand up for, they can fire their guns rhetorically at CNN. And I think that the real problem here is that suddenly everything – if your chief says you can't make any mistakes, every misstep, that poorly phrased line becomes a rallying cry, and you've seen people divert attention from really that the president of the United States, of a country that seems committed to a free press, you know, is rhetorically talking about body slamming one of the most prominent news organizations in the country on the basis of coverage that he finds unwelcome. I think that's the real issue that's been distracted from, and I think that's the problem here with what CNN did.
NPR's David Folkenflik, thank you very much. It's Here and Now. Karma Police from Radiohead's OK Computer. The landmark album from the British band came out 20 years ago this summer. And if you look it up on iTunes, the album's review starts with a question. Is it the greatest of all time? Some people think so. More than 4 million copies have been sold, and Radiohead is celebrating the anniversary with a reissue of OK Computer, including some never-before-heard songs from the original recording session. Rolling Stone senior writer Andy Green recently wrote a profile of the band and the album. Andy, thanks for joining us.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Karma Police, instantly recognizable to fans of 90s music. But take us back to 1997 and put that song and actually the entire album into context. It was different than anything else we were hearing.
Yeah, it was a really strange time for rock and roll as a genre because grunge was basically completely dead by this point. And it was the beginning of Hanson and the Spice Girls, and the mainstream rock bands were like Matchbox 20 and Creed and Bush. It just wasn't a very good time. Then out of nowhere, there's this amazing new album by this British band that just sort of shocked everybody.
And the album, I know, played a big role in your life personally. It resonated when it came out. But, the mood of this album is so dark you could wallow in the melancholy. Is that part of the appeal?
Yeah, I think it was sort of this late 90s angst about the new millennium, about new technologies, about the world changing. And the band, they tapped into this anxiety and paranoia that was in the air. And they just expressed it in a beautiful and haunting way that's really endured for a long time.
Haunting in part because Tom York, the lead singer, was haunted in a way. They had been on the road for years. In 1995, they played 177 shows. You called it a near suicidal run. But it's also happening at a time in the mid-1990s, as you say, where technology is starting to creep into our lives.
They basically lived on a tour bus for 5 straight years. Between 93 and 98, they had 1 month off. You know, their first single was Creep, this huge breakthrough song. So they just kept touring and touring. And Tom York was living on a tour bus and playing the same set each night. And as they're touring, they see the world changing. They see cell phones are becoming a huge thing. The internet is just taking off. But they're sort of watching this as observers almost from the outside through the bus window. And he just started to write down all these lyrics about all his fears and his paranoid worries about the future.
And that might explain one of the strangest songs on the album, which is Fitter, Happier.
Yeah.
We're going to listen to that.
Fitter, happier, more productive. Comfortable, not drinking too much, regular exercise at the gym, 3 days a week,
Tom York told you that he used technology as a vehicle for that loneliness that we were talking about. What about that? That is just the weirdest sounding song.
Yeah, they recorded the album at St. Catherine's Court. It's this huge mansion in Bath, England. And they had an old Mac computer there. I mean, I guess that wasn't old then, but it was a state-of-the-art Mac at the time. But the speech program they used was so basic that when they hit play on this weird poem Tom wrote, it came out in this very flat voice, was very emotion-free.
On Sundays, leaving old supermarket. No killing lots or putting boiling water on the hands. Car wash, also on Sundays. No longer afraid of
it. And it mispronounced a bunch of the words, and it just sort of was like this big brother talking. And they loved it. They put it smack dab in the center of the album. It speaks to a lot of the themes.
Is that part of what makes this album so innovative?
Yeah, I mean, it's a computer talking, and it is giving advice to people. It was sort of really the sound of 1997 in a lot of ways, when computers are just beginning to be able to do more than pay your taxes or something. I mean, they were becoming everything, and they sort of felt that.
Well, another classic is Paranoid Android. Tom York called it a cross between Bohemian Rhapsody and Happiness is a Warm Gun, the Beatles classic. Let's listen to that. This is one of those songs on the album that people might turn to first. What's significant about it?
Yeah, it's a very interesting thing, because the guys in Radiohead, the five guys, they came of age in the punk era, where prog rock was hated, where it was the enemy, it was dinosaur music. But without even realizing it, they made a prog rock song.
It's and for people who don't know what that is, what is prog rock?
It's a 70s art form. It's short for progressive rock and roll. It's very long songs with time signature shifts and complex themes out of science fiction, basically, for the most part. And the song has all of that. But they didn't even realize that they were redoing prog. They even used an old instrument that's called a mellotron on that song. That's an analog synthesizer of the 70s. And it's just this really amazing, long, complex thing. They said it was like Happiness is a Warm Gun, it meets Queen or the Pixies or something. Mm. And it was the first single off the album, which was really a bold move, because it's this challenging song. It's very un-radio-friendly. That was their first card they played, really.
Huh. Well, you mentioned St. Catherine's Court. This is the very old and supposedly very haunted mansion in England where they recorded the album. That's actually a big part of this OK Computer story, too, isn't it?
Yeah, it was owned by the actress Jane Seymour, and she was making Dr. Quinn Medicine Woman at the time, so she couldn't always be out there in Bath, England, so she rented out to bands, so The Cure recorded there. And with Radiohead, they didn't want to be in a normal studio. They wanted to record in the way that the Stones did in the 70s, or where Led Zeppelin did, where they live in a house, and just 24/7 they make music. And so it's a super old house that they felt was haunted. They could hear ghosts chattering in their ears as they slept, they all told me. Which sounds crazy, but they swore it was true. Huh. And that sort of added to all the layers of paranoia and fear you hear on the album, is they were literally in a place they felt was haunted.
Yeah, and you can hear that in the album. I mean, whether or not that's the marathon tour they went on or the place where they recorded it or whatever, something was going on that was very dark and deep inside the people who were making that album. Did they know that they had a hit right away?
I don't think they saw it as a hit, really. I think they were so wary of a hit single. They were so wary of what Creep did to them, because for so many years they were seen as the Creep band. So they didn't want a hit single. They wanted an album that worked as a piece in a lot of ways. And I think they knew it was special. They told me they felt there was real magic there. But I don't think they realized it would be hailed as the best album of the decade. I think all the acclaim of it, that really took them back and shocked them.
20 years later, Tom York has changed. He's grown up a lot. He is not the brooding 20-something that created OK Computer.
Yeah, he was telling me that he looks back upon that person as like some other person that he can barely relate to. You know, he was so exhausted back then and so young and so overwhelmed. And now he's been able, because of the success of the album, to really slow down and take years between tours. And as his words, he got a life for himself. When he made the album, he had no life, just always touring. So, yeah, it was like a 28-year-old person that was just at the end of his rope that made that album.
You said those words, slow down, man. Well, that brings me to the last song on this album, which is The Tourist. And one of the key lyrics there, hey, man, slow down. I hear that, and I just wonder if it is not even more relevant today than it was 20 years ago, especially in the context of this idea of the rise of the machines and this role that they have in our lives.
Yeah, it's funny. If you look back 20 years ago, the internet was dial-up modems. It was America Online. There was no web, really, in the way that we know it now. It was very basic. So things, you know, it sped up in so many ways. So Tom's advice was not heeded. We didn't slow down at all.
Do you think we'll be listening to this album in 40 years?
Oh, yeah. I think it's sort of like a Sgt. Pepper of the 90s. It defines the era. It stands out in a lot of ways. It's only gotten better with time. Yeah, it's a true classic.
Andy Green, senior writer at Rolling Stone magazine, will link you to his stories about the 20th anniversary of Radiohead's OK Computer at hereandnow.org. Andy, thank you.
Yeah, it was great. Thank you.
We mentioned that the reissue of the album comes with some new releases from the original recording session, including this one. It's called I Promise. You're listening to Here and Now.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from Sunbasket. Sunbasket makes it easy to cook nutritionist-approved meals in your own kitchen with organic, non-GMO ingredients from farms and fishermen sent directly to your door. Choose from paleo, gluten-free, vegetarian, breakfast, and family options. You'll get pre-measured ingredients and easy-to-follow directions and get dinner on the table in 30 minutes. It's healthy cooking designed to fit your busy lifestyle, and it's delicious. Here and Now listeners get their first three meals free at sunbasket.com/now.
The Chinese government is tightening its leash on some major financial companies in that country. These large private businesses with links to the Communist Party also have massive exposure to debt, and a government crackdown could impact the health of the global economy. Lynette Lopez is senior finance correspondent for Business Insider, and she joins us now from New York. Lynette, thanks for being here.
No problem.
Explain the issue here. What exactly is the Chinese government doing with these private businesses, and why?
Well, the Chinese government sees right now that with the current stability of the global economy, it has a window to enact reforms in its financial system. They racked up a lot of debt, especially during 2008. The Chinese government papered over the global debt crisis. It just didn't really happen for them. But now they have to pay the piper. And so all the financial institutions, the housing market, all these places where debt has collected in the Chinese economy now need to be reevaluated and some of these debts handled whenever there seemed to be some kind of crisis coming their way. Part of doing this and having the money to handle crises is making sure that Chinese money stays in China. So the financial firms we're talking about are these high-flying deal makers. Anbang, which maybe you've heard of because they bought the Waldorf Astoria and their chairman met with Jared Kushner last year. They made a lot of acquisitions here in the United States.
Well, you're right about it. Let me try to bring in another company here. It's called HNA. It's a Chinese conglomerate.
Yes.
And you go into really specific detail about the problems with that company that China is trying to mitigate.
Sure. These problems do pop up. HNA basically refused to make payments for some of its properties here in the United States. And so people fear that if there's a crackdown in China, that properties or businesses that these companies have acquired around the world will suddenly see that their cash flow is dried up as well.
You mentioned that a lot of these companies have ties to the Communist Party, which makes me wonder if there was a problem, couldn't Beijing just bail them out?
Yes, but then when do you stop? The question is, are these companies big enough and systemically important enough with around $140 billion in debt to really mean that the Chinese government has to save them? It's more important for China to save systemically important financial institutions, massive, massive banks, and make sure that those are still running. Now, one thing is Anbang has a lot of wealth management products that it's sold to retail investors. So the government is concerned about that. And the chairman of Anbang was recently taken into custody for a little while by the Chinese government. No details about how those meetings go down, but I'm sure you can imagine they're not fun.
Right. And just quickly, what's Wall Street in this country feeling about all this?
Wall Street is finally starting to realize that something is really, really rotten here, and they're not sure whether China Inc., right? The government is picking losers and it's picking winners. So the question is, do you bet that the government will save a company? Do you bet that it will not? And we don't have a sense of that yet here in the United States.
Lynette Lopez is senior finance correspondent for Business Insider. Lynette, thank you.
Have a good one.
In Poland today, President Trump warned of severe consequences if North Korea doesn't back off its missile testing program. Trump has been aggressively leaning on China to more aggressively lean on North Korea to scale back its military ambitions. China is not obliging. John Pomfret is former Washington Bureau Chief, Washington Post Bureau Chief in Beijing, and author of The Beautiful Country in the Middle Kingdom, America and China, 1776 to the Present. John's at KQED in San Francisco. Welcome back to Here and Now.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Let's start with your take on the latest North Korean missile test on the 4th of July. What does that do specifically to relationships between the U.S. and China?
Well, it's another indication that the United States' reliance on China to solve the North Korean problem has failed. And it's not simply the Trump administration, of course. It's Obama and the George W. Bush administration that basically outsourced their North Korea policy to China.
Well, let's look at a little bit of the history with President Trump. Not that there is a lot of history there, but he was decidedly unfriendly to China during the campaign. He was surprisingly friendly toward China when he took office, but now he's done another U-turn. He tweeted this week, trade between China and North Korea grew almost 40% in the first quarter. So much for China working with us, he wrote. Does President Trump have a legitimate gripe with China over North Korea?
Yeah, I think he does. From the beginning of the sanctions regimes back in the George W. Bush administration, the Chinese have undercut the U.S. position by nodding and winking at significant sanctions busting done by Chinese companies and Chinese banks that really have facilitated North Korea's both nuclear weapons and their missile development programs.
Why would China not go as far as it possibly could to try and defuse the situation with North Korea right now? We've spoken to diplomats and analysts who all say that it could be doing more. Given how much China has at stake here and not wanting the North Korean government to fail and therefore the country to fail and therefore for people throughout North Korea to flood into China, can it afford to go easier on North Korea than others would like?
The Chinese look at North Korea from the perspective of one of the last communist states in the world. North Korea is China's East Germany, if you will. And so they worry that if North Korea collapses, the Chinese government could possibly collapse as well.
How would that work? I mean, why does one cause the other?
It's a cascade. It's a cascading series of really bad developments from their perspective. You would have the Korean Peninsula united under a pro-American South Korean government. You would have the question of what to do with the 30,000 American troops. Would they go up to the Yalu River? You would have the issue of millions of Chinese Koreans who might feel the call of the motherland and start a secessionist movement in Manchuria, in China, wanting to, you know, join their turf with a united Korean peninsula. So from that perspective, it's a really bad development from their view. The second problem also, from the U.S. perspective, is that within the party state in China, there is a significant group of people who view problems for America as good things for China. And if you look at China's position on the North Korean issue, what are they encouraging right now? They're basically arguing for negotiations and a freeze on U.S.-South Korean military exercises. Basically, their goal is to degrade the operability of U.S. and South Korean forces in order to weaken somehow the U.S.-South Korean alliance, and then a freeze in North Korea. And so in the end, they actually come out a beneficiary of this type of situation far more than the United States would or the people of South Korea who are staring down the gun muzzle of the North Koreans or the Japanese as well.
Does that mean to say there that China is seeing this as kind of a power play, that if it holds out long enough, it could actually gain farther along the way?
Well, right now and for the past decade, this is not something that simply started in the Trump administration. The Chinese have had the sense that there's less pain in allowing the nuclear program of North Korea and its missile program to proceed than the possible pain from an angry America. And so until and unless the United States basically says we're going to make it worse for you, for example, sanctioning a raft of the Chinese companies that are involved in sanctions busting, the Chinese calculation is, well, North Korea can go on and do its thing because the United States is not really imposing significant pain on us. There's a cynicism here that we often in the United States ignore on the Chinese part. And their use of this problem for us as a way to leverage it and gain benefits in Northeast Asia, I think, is a significant point that we ignored our risk.
What would the United States then have to do to make sure that China does something and feels the pain by not doing anything over North Korea?
Under the two terms of the Obama administration, the Obama administration only sanctioned one Chinese company once for its business ties with North Korea. Now, the Trump administration over the last 2 weeks has begun to sanction Chinese companies. There's the Bank of Dandong and several other Chinese entities. They're going to have to sanction a lot more. And they're not simply sort of fly-by-night Chinese firms who are involved in this. They're major Chinese companies that do actually a lot of business in the United States. That has to begin.
How much did the sanctions hurt those companies hurt the government?
Not necessarily hurting the government, but the sanctions will hurt those companies. And those companies need to be outed. And from what I understand, the Treasury Department has a significant list of major Chinese firms that have been involved in this type of trade with the North Koreans. There needs to be that reckoning, if you will. And if the Chinese still won't come to the table and play more honestly than they have been, more needs to be done. But this is sort of the first important step, which the Trump administration took in a very small way over the last 2 weeks.
If China would be forced into action, in your point of view, by more sanctions, harsher sanctions on their companies from the United States, what's the reason the United States hasn't gone that route? You said under President Obama it hasn't. It may be now under Donald Trump, but there must be a reason why it's in the U.S.'s favor to hold back.
During the Obama administration, people argued against sanctioning Chinese companies because they were worried about influencing the broader relationship with America, involving trade, involving climate change, involving even the Iran sanctions. The problem now is that the North Korean issue has become the issue between the United States and China. In fact, it's really a test case about how the U.S. relationship with China is going to proceed going forward. And if the Chinese aren't willing to play ball on this issue, which is really of critical importance to the United States, I mean, this is a regime which has basically declared that they're our enemy and is now building a nuclear weapon and building the ICBM, the delivery system to deliver it to our shores. If the Chinese are not willing on this issue to bend and to push the North Koreans more aggressively, then what use is the relationship, the broader relationship, if on this most critical issue they're actually not willing to help the United States? And I think this is the calculus that people are now debating within the Trump administration.
You spent years in China watching the government there, trying to understand the government there. You're in the United States right now. What do you think President Trump has right and wrong about China and vice versa? What do the Chinese make of Donald Trump? You think in correct ways and incorrect?
I think the Chinese initially during the campaign were kind of amazed by Trump. He's such a showman. And his businessman background, because in China right now, the most popular people in China, they used to be like actually American sports stars, like Michael Jordan was extremely popular in China. But now in China, the entrepreneur is the most popular person in China, like Jack Ma from Alibaba. And so Trump kind of went into that and took that space as the American entrepreneur. Then, of course, there were these, you know, anti-China comments that Trump made in the campaign, and it was a little bit difficult. He threw into question the one China policy. But once the Mar-a-Lago meeting happened with Xi Jinping, the Chinese leadership, I think, began to view Trump as someone they could play. And they did nothing, actually, to rein in North Korean behavior at all. And then you have Trump kind of flipping and being tough on China, not only on North Korea, but announcing an arms package for Taiwan, doing more freedom of navigation operations in the South China Sea, and putting the squeeze on the Chinese. And the Chinese then did the absolute minimum, and then he's basically saying, well, you haven't done enough, and so now he's pushing forward. And that was something that he actually said he was going to do, and the Chinese ignored the signals.
And so he could have a better read on China by doing what?
I don't know how much Trump pays attention to China, other than tweeting every so often. But he does have some very good people, actually, in the administration looking at China. The question is whether he's getting their advice.
John Pomfret is former Washington Post bureau chief in Beijing and author of the book The Beautiful Country in the Middle Kingdom, America and China, 1776 to the present. Thanks a lot, John.
Thanks for having me.
If you've ever been to Times Square in New York City, you've probably looked up in awe at the towering billboards. Today, the ads are mostly computer-generated, but starting in the 1880s, hand-painted billboards were popular as part of a wave of outdoor advertising for circuses and theaters. By the end of the century, it was a full-scale industry, one that has waned in the modern world. As Topher Forges reports, the art is making a comeback, thanks in part to social media.
Liam McWilliams is suspended on a rig against a four-story brick building in Lower Manhattan. He's about 40 feet above the street. The narrow rig sways and creaks when he moves around.
Yeah, the rig kind of has the same effect as like a boat. There's, I guess, like the sea legs.
McWilliams is here to hand paint a billboard for the international clothing company G-Star Raw. The large painted face of musician Pharrell, dressed in a camouflage jacket, stares down at him. Black, yellow, and red cans of paint line the floor of the rig. In fact, everything on the rig is covered in paint, including McWilliams. His black puffy jacket is covered in a rainbow of splotches, brown, white, blue, and more. McWilliams works for a company called Colossal Media. He uses a thin brush to fill in the lettering on the wall. He says there's maybe one day of work left.
Into completion, so right now it's filling in the background, doing any highlights or touch-ups, finishing the letters, and then just making sure it's a nice, clean product.
Down on the street, Kevin Berbalak stares up at the billboard. He works nearby and takes breaks on a bench that faces the mural. He says he's been watching McWilliams and his partner paint throughout the week.
They got pretty far in 5 days, though. You don't see much, you know, hand paintings anymore, you know? Everything's done on the computer. So that should catch everybody's eye.
It also caught his camera's eye. Berbalak takes a photo and posts it on Facebook.
Coming along nice, I said.
Spreading hand-painted billboards online is the next step in the growth of a once nearly dead industry. Paul Lindahl is a co-founder of Colossal Media. He says that during their heyday, hand-painted billboards were the only way brands could reach people on the street on a large-scale level. But modern technology put an end to that.
There was, you know, large format printers introduced and big banners and LED screens. And the advantage to that is that you can pump out more work quicker and cheaper. And so you started to see a lot of that during the 80s.
And by the time Lindahl started Colossal in 2004, hand-painted billboards were scarce, and he says companies weren't interested in commissioning any.
The first 2 years, you know, was like a real uphill battle. There was a couple of people that took a chance on us, and everything that we did, we used to our advantage the next time we came to a table with a naysayer.
Lindahl says they went from brand to brand and agency to agency, slowly gaining clients. Today, the company paints about 450 pieces a year all across the country. Lindahl says there's so much demand, he has to turn down work.
Right now, we're doing as many paintings as we can and trying to get the crew like built up to be able to support all that stuff. But what we see for the future is getting our message and brand messaging out further with social media.
Colossal and its clients can plan to make videos or photos to share online, but its managing director, Kelly Pepper, says bystanders can spread a billboard in a way companies can't.
And they take a picture and they put it on their social media. And for a brand, that's like priceless. Like to have somebody talk about your brand, your advertisement, as a piece of artwork rather than this item that they can buy in the store. I can't think of a better like win-win for a brand.
For example, a 2015 Colossal campaign for the candy bar Snickers featured the face of Marsha Brady on the side of a building. Below her face was the hashtag What's Up With Marsha. Over 2 weeks, painters morphed Marsha's face into that of actor Danny Trejo. The completed project showed Trejo's face, the Snickers logo, and of course, the hashtag. That hashtag spread. When Colossal reviewed the project's reach, they found the hashtag had been viewed almost 7 million times just on Twitter alone. Angel Sami co-founded Overall Murals, also based in New York City. She says some campaigns are designed with social media as a main feature, like the one they recently worked on with Adidas that was like a mural scavenger hunt.
The murals could only be seen if you took a photo of it because it was done with a reflective paint that was activated by a flash. So they did a contest on Twitter where they called out three locations and gave hints where these three locations were.
So if you went and took some pictures of the walls, you got a free pair of shoes. Sami says the response was quick. Back in Manhattan, Kevin Berbalak checks to see if anyone liked the photo he took of the mural.
One person so far. I only shared it 6 minutes ago and one person gave me a like.
Not quite viral, but it's a start. For Here and Now, I'm Topher Forges.
And later today, we'll visit some would-be astronauts who are simulating what life on Mars might be like. In a remote Utah desert. We'll have that story on All Things Considered. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. This is Here and Now.